Every single day, people take unwanted or unused items to thrift and antique stores across the country. But as the saying goes, one man's trash is another man's treasure, and we're here to prove it. Identify valuable things before you throw them away. Join us as we show and tell of treasures found and sold by a full-time reseller with the hopes of helping you find some treasures of your own. Welcome to the What's Sold podcast.
Welcome back to the What's Sold podcast. My name is Brandon. I'm here with my good friend Matt Brock, also known as Rusty the Reseller. I probably don't need to keep saying that every show, Matt, but it is helpful for those people that have discovered us through Rusty. So yeah. We are back with another show. I thought it'd be a good idea periodically to check in about why we're doing this show. So can you tell me, we just had in our pre-production meeting, we were talking about sort of the general reason for this. There are, by the way, world, there are 4 to 5 million podcasts out there. We're just one. We're just the very best of them. But but why are we doing what we're doing, Matt? Can you tell the people that are listening in?
Yeah, I mean, I thought we were going to try to keep this a secret, but really the ultimate goal is to try to convince people of which political side that they should, get onto in the upcoming election. Seriously though, the reason we do this show is, I think, we're trying to educate and give advice to people who have interest in maybe just simply knowing the value of things that they already have, or trying to learn how to sell things and make profit off of items that they can find or items that they already have. Some people inherit things. They don't really need them or want them or care about them. They like to move them on, but they don't know, should they donate them? Do they have any value? Should we sell them? Where should I do that at? How do I even get started? I've never done that before. But then you've got people like me who do it full time, have done it for a long time, and they've amassed a lot of valuable information about how to do these things. And so for hours and hours and years of work, I'm going to try to synthesize things that I've learned and pass them along to anyone who cares to hear. Maybe that can help you out if you're listening.
Yeah, it's funny because when you were talking, I was thinking about before we even started working together, before we started doing this show, I had a friend whose father had passed away, and she had a house that she needed to clear out. So she had this huge, just big tool room full of tools. And she was like, I don't know what to do with all this stuff. I don't know if anything has any value. And she was literally selling things for like $5. And I was like, well, you shouldn't be selling. You came in and basically purchased the whole lot and gave her way more than she would have ever gotten if she tried to do it on her own. And that, so that it was not only that, but it was also the idea. Number one, you knew what you were looking at. So you could say, this has value. I could sell this and make money on it. And there's also this service that's being given to people. And I'm only saying that to people listening is like, don't think that you're taking from them. You're in a sense offering a service of helping people, especially people that are clearing out maybe their father or mother's closets. Sometimes that's just like, hey, I want someone to come in and do it. So if you can find those, that's a win-win. So everyone in that thing, it benefits.
There's a couple of different avenues by which you can buy and sell. One is you just sell things that you already have or you inherited, which I mentioned before. Another is you go out actively looking for things in various types of places, online or locally. But then there's that side of things that you mentioned where maybe you come into contact with somebody and they have a problem. So this person you were describing, they had a problem. The problem is they have all of this stuff in a place and they need to move it because they need to get a house ready to sell. Or a person's family member dies. You know, Joe in San Francisco, he grew up in Illinois. And so he's his father died. And so he's only got a week and a half off of work. He's got to fly over there. Now he's got this whole house, all this stuff. Maybe he takes a day and picks out the stuff he cares about. He doesn't care about anything else. He doesn't want to just donate it all, but he also doesn't even really know how to evaluate it. He certainly doesn't have the time to do it the right way. And so someone like me might be able to come in and say, hey, you got a problem. Your problem is you need to move this stuff fast. Well, I do that. So let's talk about the value here. I can purchase these items, get them out of your way. I can even clean up after myself. And then you're prepared to be able to get that house on the market. You can get back to your family and take care of them, and you solve that stuff. Those are all possibilities. Now, the ability to do the latter thing I mentioned, most people aren't able to do that, certainly not in the beginning, unless you just have tens of thousands of dollars sitting around right, ready for capital. And I certainly didn't when I started. I oftentimes don't even now. But I like that because I get to work with one person. I'm not wasting time driving around on days when I really don't find much. I can put a lot of money in, but I'm immediately getting a lot of inventory. I can work off of that for months, not having to drive around, not having to worry. If another health crisis happens and I'm shut down, I still have plenty of product to sell and work for myself and my family. And I also help somebody out. And that was, we can walk away and we both feel good about the transaction monetarily. And I also help them solve a problem. I mean, that was my background's in mental health. So I was a therapist for many years. And when you came to me, it's because you had a problem. Either you believed and knew you had a problem, or somebody told you you had a problem. But either way, there were some problems that needed to be worked on. And that was my job, was to help people sort through that stuff. So this is a completely different field and life for me now. But a lot of those skills that I utilized come in handy now when I'm interacting with people, certainly. I enjoy it. There's lots of aspects about this job that I really do enjoy. It doesn't come without its own difficulties, like any job.
Yeah.
But that's what this is about. That's a long intro. We're here to talk about buying and selling things. You have things already at your home, listener, that have value. And hopefully you can learn some things from us in this podcast that will, at the very least, you'll gather some information, and now you're armed with that knowledge for the future, whether you're using it today or maybe you don't need it for 5 years, but you're going to have it when that time comes.
Yeah, it kind of strikes me, Matt, you're an attic doctor. You're, in a sense, healing attics and basements, and not attics with the D, okay, but A-T-T-I-C-S.
Oh, look at that.
Well,
that,
but there is some incredible value to that. I was just sitting here thinking when my dad died, we had to deal with this just big, giant space. We had, he had a storage unit, all this stuff, and we're like, oh, yeah, what? So to have had a mat to be able to come in and look at it and say, I could almost see this being a business where someone says, hey, I will pay you $500 to clear all this stuff out. The mat says, okay, I will take the $500 and I will take all this stuff and I will sell it at wherever. I guess the point I'm trying to make, there are a lot of nuances. You are teaching me as we're going. I am learning with our fellow listeners out there as we go along. But what strikes me is there is a real, real need for this type of thing to be able to be a person that can understand the nuances, what are needed when these kinds of things happen. Not just that, maybe someone's moving and they only have a week and they got to clear their house out. There's just a lot. So being able to be, I always say are you aware of the potential opportunities in front of you or not? Because sometimes if you're just aware, things happen. Mm-hmm. And so that's the basic reason why we're doing this. We hope people gathering it. But let's segue into today's show and the topic. What are we going to talk about today? Again, Matt likes to keep me in the dark, and I appreciate that. It makes me think on my feet as we go.
It makes me feel very powerful and in control when I'm the only one that knows something.
I have talked about your narcissism a lot, Matt. So, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, maybe we'll do some, if it were up to me, we'll make some whole episodes about all the stuff I know. But,
sure.
No, so today's episode is going to be about, it's the What Sold podcast. So I'm going to start by showing something that did sell, and then I'm going to turn everything on its head today and talk about things that I can't sell.
Oh.
Because that is also useful information if you're selling on online platforms to know certain items that are restricted or completely outlawed on that platform. You're not allowed to do it for legal reasons or otherwise. The first item today is it's a small skeleton key. And I'm going to hold it up right here. It's even bent a little bit at the top. It's just got a round circular top that would say connect it to a keychain. And then the bottom is like a standard kind of, if you've ever seen a skeleton key, you know what I'm talking about. It goes to the end, it comes out to the side. This particular one, though, is hollow on the inside as well. So it went to a particular type of lock, probably a door lock. This is from the 1800s. I can't really date it exactly, but I know it's late 1800s, early 1900s at the latest. It's a cool little key. sold for $12. Now, you're not going to retire on sales like that, but a person might see this in a junk drawer. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you go to the grandparents' house and there's just like this random key, or it's in the garage, mm-hmm. right? It's like someplace on a shelf, and you're like, oh yeah, they're kind of cool, but like I don't, that has no value. Pitch it. It does have value. People collect these. They do all kinds of things, projects, crafting things, art, artistic things.
Yeah, because it is a very beautiful item. It's not just like keys today, you're sort of used to everybody see them. That's an actually artistic looking. And I'll put, again, just to remind everybody, we finally got a robust way of looking at pictures. I put it into all the show notes.
Robust.
So take a look at the Facebook page that we have, and I will have a picture of that key up. But you get a sense of, it's not just a normal key. It's a beautiful key. So yeah, people would probably buy that for various reasons.
And the reason, now, if I had been out at a thrift store and I see this and somebody wants a dollar even for it, or $2, I'm not buying that. Because to buy something for a dollar and sell it for 10 or 12, like that's a 10-time profit, but it's such small change. Like it doesn't really, it's not worth my time.
Right.
But I got that key at an estate sale where I bought a large lot of antique tools and various other things. As I was picking through tools, I found an old lock, a lock from like the 1800s. And it didn't have a key, but locks have really, high values. Some can have really, really high values. And when I saw that, I kept looking. I found another one. I found in like 5 minutes, I found 15 old locks. And then I came across this little toolbox and I opened it up and the entire thing was full of keys. Every type of key you can think of. Keys for doors, keys for locks, keys for safety deposit boxes, keys for old vehicles like a early 1900s Model T Ford and things like that. So I'm like, holy cow, this is awesome. So I take the whole thing up. I end up getting the whole thing for $10. So the toolbox itself has utility. I could sell that by itself. People can put tools in it. Mm-hmm. All of the keys and all of the locks. I mean, that entire lot that I paid $10 for, probably at the end of the day when I sell everything, I'm going to get somewhere between $300 and $400.
Wow.
So whenever I go through, I have a little keychain, maybe 8 or 10 keys on it. Is it worth my time to pull every single key off? I mean, if I do some research and find that they're valuable individually, then it does. But otherwise, I make a lot, $10 for this set of keys. Because after I sell this one key made me all my money back. Now everything I have no cost of goods in. And that's how you fill up an eBay store over time. You can get thousands of items in a store because you're not floating money anymore. It's not like you got to sell really fast mm-hmm. because you're floating all this money. You're not floating anything. As long as you have a place that you're storing it that's not too expensive, and keys, things of the size of keys, you can store thousands upon thousands of those in a very small amount of space, mm-hmm. provided you keep good inventory of what you have so you can find it when it sells. But that was a sale. It's not a huge sale, but I think people need to realize that even small things that may not even be useful to you, like a key without a lock or a lock without a key, those still have value and people will buy them.
Huh. Fascinating. I would never thought that people would want to buy old locks, but I think about it. There's those old, really cool locks that have the clasp on them and the skeleton, like from, I don't know, like from an 1800 lock. I would like, oh, that'd be kind of cool to have.
Yeah, like jail, for jails or for railroad locks, things like that can sell for a lot. People may just do some research on the lock and see similar, like find the exact same one for sale. And that one has a key with it. Oh, well, let me examine this key. Now I know the type of key I need. Maybe somebody did that. Maybe this is actually going to a lock someone has without the key.
Huh.
Or you can do vice versa. So there's buyers for all of those things. So that's the thing that's sold. What I want to talk about today is an item that I actually come across pretty regularly. I would say monthly. I come across these. I'm not, except for rare cases, and one of the rare cases I will share today, I don't purchase them. Because I know I either can't sell them or it's going to be very, very difficult for me to sell. And what I'm talking about today is items made out of ivory.
Hey.
Ivory, which is the tusk of an elephant, had been harvested for, I don't know, thousands of years. I don't know how long they've been killing elephants and harvesting their tusks and using them for various things. But there were lots of different things that were created out of ivory. And I don't remember the actual date offhand when it became illegal to sell. And obviously they're doing that because they're trying to curb the senseless killing of these majestic, really intelligent and cool animals.
Mm-hmm.
Elephants, by the way, are super intelligent. And did you know that they're like one of the loudest animals? They can make one of the loudest sounds of any animals. It's something like like people who work at zoos with elephants end up having hearing loss problems because they can create this infrasonic sound that's so deep it go like 10 miles other elephants can hear it, but it's below our threshold of hearing.
Really?
So it's, we don't ever hear it, but it's like damaging their eardrums.
Oh, wow.
Because it's happening. Yeah, so elephants, tusk, ivory, you can't sell it. You can't sell it legally. I have read, now I don't know how I would go about proving this unless I purchased something that had paperwork, documentation, and provenance, but if you can prove that it was harvested and used for jewelry or whatever it's on prior to some date, that you could legally sell it maybe in some outlets.
Mm.
But I think that the ability to do that and prove it would be very difficult. I certainly can't do that by buying it out of a jewelry bin at a thrift store locally,
right,
for example.
Unless it was like from 14th century Africa and they just didn't know it, I suppose.
Sure. But again, I would have to, at the very least, I would have to take it to someone who could authenticate it. I would have to pay them probably a hefty fee to do so. And then I would still be at risk trying to sell it.
Mm.
Because if somebody caught me, you know, so I don't do it. But there are actually a lot of really cool pieces of jewelry, for example, and other items that are made out of ivory. So I own some. I haven't thrown them away because it's hard for me to do that because they're interesting. They had a purpose, but I also don't know how to sell them. So what I'm going to talk about today, and I'm going to show some of these items, I'm going to talk about, so I think the first question maybe people are asking themselves, and maybe you have the same question, is, well, how do I know if something is made out of ivory or not? Because there are several substances that can look like ivory. Ivory itself, bone, and faux kinds of ivory, mm-hmm. which are usually made out of a resin or some sort of celluloid, like a plastic.
Mm.
I'm going to show you a couple of my favorites first today. And these are items that are called, I think the pronunciation is netsuke. Netsuke. Have you ever heard of that before?
No. No idea what you're talking about.
So what I'm holding up, and I'll try to describe these best again, there you'll be able to look at photos online. But these are little carved figurines. And I'm going to hold it up closer so you can kind of see. This particular one here is of a couple of Asian men, and they're holding on to like these, it looks like they're ropes around their necks. They're facing one another. They're sitting, and it's very intricately carved. There, you can see their faces. They've got mustaches and things. And on the bottom, if you roll it over, you can see it's carved like a fish. So it's like they're standing on fish, and they are. And it's this three-dimensional figure. What you'll notice at the bottom are two little holes, and those holes are drilled through all the way. I'll explain what that is in just a moment. So that's the first one. The second one is this little character. It's another carved person holding on to something. And when you roll it over, it looks like a shell. So it's almost like he's standing on a gigantic shell, like he would be in a water, like a small boat mm-hmm. or something. And it's very intricately carved, really, really cool. And it's quite heavy. Netsuke are these carved figurines. I believe they originated in Japan when people wore those robes, like kimonos. They would usually tie it around a belt. They didn't have pockets in these things, as far as I know, at least back in the day. So then how do you carry items with you if you don't have any pockets? And they would take these little pouches that had a rope or a cord on them, and they would loop it over the belt that they would tie their robe with. And these, with the little holes that are drilled in them, were made so that you could put a string or a rope down through them, and this acted as a counterweight on the other side of the pouch. So if you think of a pocket watch, there's a pocket watch on one end, and then you have the fob on the other end that acts as a counterweight, or it's attached to something to keep it attached to your body. So these would be attached to a string on one side, and then on the other side of the string would be a pouch that they could carry small items with them, like a purse or something.
So did you date these?
I don't know the exact date on these. At one time I did some research and I didn't exactly find when they were dated. They do on both of them have small characters at the bottom that are likely referencing the person who, the artisan themselves who created it, but they might reference a time period, or a lot of times with, say, and this is maybe true for Chinese and Japanese, things like pottery and ceramics, they'll have various characters, and sometimes one character is reference to a time period, another one is a reference to the leader of their country at the time, and so it sort of helps to date. Usually you're dating within a particular time period, mm-hmm. not like a specific year. So these are really cool. I can't sell them because they're made out of ivory. Now, I'll pause for a moment and say, these are the characteristics that help you easily identify ivory. Ivory, are you familiar with like sketching or techniques of drawing at all, Brandon?
No.
So there's a technique in sketching called cross-hatching. Are you familiar with this? It's basically
making fish
X's
together in a hatchery? No, Matt, I have no idea.
No. So you're just making like little X's, little crosses. And if you do it a lot, it will make it darker. And if you do it less, it'll be lighter. And
you realize that the people out there that are listening that are kind of artistic and the type of people that are going are like, that guy, Brandon, is a real idiot. He doesn't know, cross hatching. What? Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Sorry, people, I don't know. Matt is the expert here.
Well, I am in no way trying to condescend. I want to explain something if it's not obvious.
Sure. It is definitely not obvious, and I feel like I have a fair knowledge of things, and I have never heard of that. So
Maybe I made it up.
No,
you really can't
so.
Tell with me. You can't tell
One
with
thing
me.
Is before you go into that, what's interesting yes. about those pieces, there's that whole thing is fascinating. Now, we're talking about secondary market reselling, but that type of item, you got to remember that ivory is not indigenous to Japan. They had to get it from somewhere else, and ivory has always mm-hmm. been very valued. It's been valued for the Japanese people for a lot of reasons. I won't go into the history of it, but I would bet you anything that if that was for holding kimonos together, so there's a couple interesting things. Before the Meiji Restoration in 1868, so Japan was forced open, that was when kimonos were worn typically. So you kind of wonder, like, wait, was this older than 1868? Maybe it goes back to, who knows? My point being is that when you run across something like that, as a historian by training, I would say, huh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Let's think about it. My point is, it might be worth doing a deeper dive. That's all my point.
No, you're absolutely right. And I can't sell them here in the United States, but if I could somehow work something out with someone in another country where they don't have those laws outlawing the sale, maybe they could sell it. But yes, these could be 200-300 years old. I don't actually know. Sometimes you can find things very quickly and easily in searching online, and other times it's very difficult. But going back momentarily to what I was saying about identification of these is, and I'm going to hold up a pair of earrings that are also made of ivory, and hopefully you can see them, but if not, you'll be able to see them on the pictures. They're just round. Flat on one side, around on the other. And I don't know if my camera will show it very well. And it's going to be really bright. You can maybe barely see it. It's hatched. You can see it's like crisscross on there. And it's a little bit bright. But there's lines that kind of go across it. And it's just like several X's all around it. And that's just the way that it forms. That's the way that that bone or that tusk formed. Because it's an organic matter. And that's how you can tell typically, usually, well, almost always, ivory pieces are smooth. They're going to be very smooth. They're going to have that cross hatching. And you can't always tell by looking at every angle. You have to turn it until you get to the correct angle to see. Sometimes you can only tell on the back of a piece or on the front or on the side. And it's usually carved. I mean, it's carved. To get it down small,
right,
it had to be carved. So in contrast to something that is made of plastic or celluloid, those things are going to be like lighter in weight typically, and they aren't actually carved. They're going to be molded.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have been poured into a mold. Now, it can be confusing, and you need to get a loop out, and you need to have, ideally you have a piece of the genuine thing so that you can kind of look at it and familiarize yourself.
A loop is a little a glass thing.
A little magnifying glass, correct.
Yeah, magnifying glass, got it.
Yep, like jewelers use. Here's a piece that is made of celluloid. It is, you can see it's painted, it's hand painted. It's a little brooch that's just floral, red, yellow, and green.
Pretty.
On the back, it's just kind of flat, but it looks like it's carved on the front, but it's actually not carved. It was poured in to a mold. It's just that the mold had been carved out, right? So it's getting the reverse image of what that is. Now, I'm holding up next to it a pair of earrings. I'm going to pull these up next. They're also floral. They look like pink flowers with like little green leaves next to them. Now, these are made of ivory. So just looking on here and maybe even looking on our photos, you wouldn't necessarily tell the difference. But turning around on the back, and I'll make sure to show this, you probably can't tell from your angle, but you can see very distinctly the cross hatching on the back of this. So if you look at the back of the previous piece made of celluloid and the back of these, you can, if it's very obvious to tell the difference. So cross hatching is ivory. You don't want to see cross hatching. The third item that sometimes confuses people is bone. So bovine bone mm-hmm. was used in a lot of jewelry, beads, carvings like these floral carvings. Bone is usually rougher. It usually has more straight lines, if any lines at all. And if you look close, oftentimes you're going to see little tiny holes or pitting mm-hmm. because bone is porous and it has tubes that run through it. That's the way that it forms. You're not going to see cross-hatching on it. It's going to be lines and little holes. Sometimes it'll be a little brown in the hole, like because it's a hole, so it collects dust and mm-hmm. moisture and other things over time. You're wearing this jewelry, skin particles, and things from the person who was wearing it. It can get dirty,
sure.
You know? That's how you know you can't sell ivory. The last thing I'm going to show you here is another necklace. These are all pieces that I'm showing today are pieces that I've come across in jewelry lots and things that I didn't buy it specifically, but as I sorted through it, I discovered them. This is a really cool necklace. And you can see has four sections that are almost like curved pieces. And then they're held together in the middle with little wire or chain. And then these little balls. And these balls are floral. I'll talk about those in a second. But these bands right here are carved ivory. And you can see, if I get up close, you can kind of maybe start to see the texture there of the cross hatching. So this is definitely ivory. And these little balls are an interesting thing in themselves. They're called cloisonné. Are you familiar with cloisonné jewelry?
No, Matt. I'm not familiar with cloisonné.
Did you ever have an Etch-a-Sketch when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay. So that's our starting point. So an Etch-a-Sketch, you know, you,
wait,
you kind
did
of
you just,
turn the knobs.
Did you just dumb this whole episode down for me?
Yeah.
Audience, do you feel like he just said, listen, okay, child. Etch-a-Sketch. All right, here you go. All right, similar to that. All right, sorry.
Oh, you picked up on it. But actually, the reason I use this as an example is it's actually a pretty easy way to explain it. So if you're using Etch-a-Sketch, you know it's kind of like that line uh-huh. that you're going around. Now imagine instead of it being an Etch-a-Sketch, those lines are wire, and you're just using wire to make an image, right? You're curving it around or whatever. So what they do is they take wire, and they make some sort of a shape or like a flower or something out of it. And they're putting it onto something, either flat or it could be three-dimensional, like these little round beads, these balls. Once they do that, they take this type of paste, this like enamel paste that's mixed with glass mm-hmm. powder and dye, and they pour it into the spaces around the wire, and then they heat it up, and it melts it, the glass and everything, it melts it into place. So what you're looking at here in these different shapes and colors, these flowers and stuff, around those flowers is actually wire.
Oh, wow.
And then the colors are that enamel paste and stuff that are in there.
Wow, that's beautiful.
It's a specific type of, and I don't know where it originated. Probably Italy or, you know what I mean, someplace like that in Europe. Maybe in Asia. I actually don't know. I don't know that. But this is a really cool piece because it incorporates some really cool beads. Now, if I wanted to sell this, I could probably deconstruct this, take the ivory off, and either hang these beads on as a pendant on a necklace and sell them. I could sell them, the beads by themselves have value, but as a piece as intact as it is, as it was originally intended, I can't sell it or I will get in trouble.
Now, let me ask you a question. If you find a piece, let's just say you're a person that's like, yeah, I don't want to kill elephants and I agree with the ivory, not selling ivory.
Mm-hmm.
And you look
mm-hmm.
at a piece like that, which looks fairly old. I have no idea of the age of it. Is that something you might take to a local museum? Like, I'm thinking to myself, a curator in a museum might say, wow, that's a beautiful example of West African blah, 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 or whatever it is.
Yes.
Could you, is it worth taking that and donating it to me? Is that even possible?
I certainly think it is possible. You would need to do some research, find places that maybe have things on display already or would be interested. You send them an email mm-hmm. and you see if you get a response. The ones like these Netsuke, these are the type of thing that probably could find their way back to their country of origin, and they might want to display them as part of their heritage, part of their cultural, you know, identity, because that's where it originated, not the tusk itself.
By the way, I looked up Netsuke, and those are probably, at the very least, over 100 years old. Netsuke fell out of favor in the 19th century, so the 1800s. So those could even predate that. So those two pieces you have there could be 200-300 years old, which it's just amazing to me.
Yeah, the history of it is absolutely fascinating. Now, I got two more things to talk about. I'm now going to show you something that I did actually buy yesterday. So this is brand new.
Oh.
And this is an example of buying something that had ivory in it that I actually didn't know it was ivory until I got back and more closely examined it. But that it wasn't for that the reason I bought it. But I'm going to show you now. It's this item. And what it looks like, it resembles like an Arabian sword.
Yeah, scimitar.
A scimitar. So the blade, I'm going to say, is right around between 10 and 12 inches long. And the handle is probably more like 5 inches long. The handle is made in almost, it comes down and it looks as if it's a knot at the bottom of it. And you hold it and it's thin. So the blade is made of a material that is not metal. The handle is sterling silver. So this blade, this long, almost 12 inch long blade, is made out of ivory. And I didn't know it when I bought it. That's not why I bought it. I couldn't quite tell because, again, I said before, you really have to see it. You have to look at it from a specific angle in order to tell for sure. And I had to get a loupe out, which I didn't have with me. My mistake. I had to look at the thin portion of the blade in order to identify it. But the reason I bought it is that on the hilt, where it connects this blade portion, it says Tiffany & Company, New York. So this is a sterling silver handle. Would you venture to guess what you think this item actually is, Brandon?
Is it a...
I'll give you a hint. It is not a knife and it is not a sword.
Well, I know it wasn't a sword, but it definitely looks like a scimitar. Was it cake? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's not a bad guess. It's kind of shaped like smaller knives that are shaped like this that are actually made out of metal oftentimes are called fish knives that were made for, I guess, serving fish. I don't know. But...
No,
this,
I think gutting this fish.
Gutting fish, yeah. Sure. So this is actually what they call a page turner. So back in Victorian times and even before that, if you had this large book, they would use this. It's almost like if it were smaller, you would think it was a letter opener, but it's much like twice as long as what a traditional letter opener would be. So they would use this to put in these big pages and turn the pages in a book.
Wow. Why?
Yeah. Because...
They're Victorian?
Yeah, because they had manners.
Well,
man.
I know that when it comes to the Torah, that you do not touch the Torah with your hand, so that there are actually page turners of the Torah. So
okay, well, and maybe it's possible that was you. Maybe this was used for some sort of religious thing, but this is the thing that's weird, and I'm trying to figure it out. And I actually am going to get on some Facebook groups of people who collect Tiffany & Company antique items because I want to get some other people's opinions on this.
Can you tell us how much you paid for it?
Yeah, I paid $300 for it.
Oh, wow.
$300. It's a lot of money, but just handles with nothing on them have sold for as much as $1,500 at places like Sotheby's and Christie's in the last 3 months. So I thought, at the very least, I'm going to get my money back. I don't think that's a problem. But on the other side where it says Tiffany, it has some markings, if you look really closely with a loop. These markings it's the letters H and A. It's the symbol of an anchor. Turned to the side, the letter P, and a lion. And these are like stamps, like a maker's manufacturer's mark. I looked these up, and what I've identified is that the H&A stands for Horton and Alday, which was an assayist. They made precious metals. The anchor to the side stands for Birmingham, which I don't know if that's a city or if it's just a region, but it's an English area that did...
Birmingham's a city.
It is a city.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, so Birmingham, the city. The letter symbol is for 1870, and then the lion means sterling silver. So this is a sterling silver handle from made in 1870 in Birmingham, England, by Horton and Alday. So what's confusing to me about that is that even though the Tiffany & Company started in the 1840s, I believe, so they were definitely a company... But they're an American company. They're not an English company. So I don't know why this is stamped Tiffany & Company unless that is something that was done afterwards, either by Tiffany & Company. Like, did Tiffany & Company buy metal, sterling silver pieces from Horton & Alday and then white label it for themselves? Or is this somebody's attempt at fooling me or whoever else wants to buy it.
Interesting.
So that's what I got to find out is why. I mean, I'm much more likely to believe these British metal maker marks than I am the Tiffany portion. It also has a number on here. I'm just flabbergasted. I don't know what this is exactly. I'm not 100% sure that it's a page turner, although that's what it looks like when I do research. But all that to say, I paid $300 for something I thought I could sell, and now I can't sell it unless I find some creative way to do so that's legal, or I just have to snap this ivory off.
Oh, no!
And sell just the handle.
No!
Which I also don't want to do.
Oh, my gosh.
So
you do that, tell me, I'll
say,
buy it, and I'll donate
to somebody. Do not waste... Yeah, and this could be a donation piece, but do not waste money on a thing unless you examine it, because if you could do the same thing. You could buy something and not be able to sell it and lose your money.
Yeah.
Be aware you can't sell ivory. The last thing I want to say, because we're running late on time, is that we spend a lot of time talking about things that you can't sell, and people are like, well, I really want to know what I can sell, please. Okay, well, thank you for staying this long into the episode, because I'm going to talk about one more item. And this is the same, this is sort of similar in the sense that this is the type of thing you can also find mixed in with all kinds of other costume jewelry that the people selling it don't know, just like they wouldn't know a piece was made out of ivory. I'm going to show you a necklace. This necklace is a beaded necklace. These beads are pink and white, and they're all carved to look like little tulips. And it has a 14-karat yellow gold clasp on the end of it as well. So that's an indication that this is probably nicer. And what you're looking at, do you want to guess before I say what it is, Brandon? You probably know what it is.
It looks like almost like puka shell that Greg Brady would wear. But
it does. It does. You're not far off.
Oh.
So this is called angel skin, or they describe as angel skin coral. So this is coral from the ocean.
Nice.
Angel skin because it's this pink color. Coral comes in all kinds of colors, white, mm-hmm. black, red, and really red and the angel skin tend to bring higher values. But this was a $3 purchase at a thrift store. Now, I personally put the 14-karat gold clasp on it. It had just a regular claw clasp on it. Mm-hmm. I took that off and put this on to add value because I just had it laying around. But this is like a $75 to $100 necklace, even without the clasp on it, because these are all hand-carved. Now, in contrast to ivory, you can sell coral. It's legal. You can do it. I do it all the time. I find coral jewelry pretty much every month. But look out for this stuff. It's pink. It's got some heavier weight to it, so you can tell it's not plastic. It doesn't look like glass. It's coral. So the only thing I will, and this is like a deeper dive, but there's a lot of branch coral. It looks like the actual branches that's red that are put on necklaces that seem like this really valuable. Because red coral, like genuine red coral, brings high values. But if you were to cut into that piece, it's going to be white on the inside. Because not unlike a lot of different materials that look like turquoise, they can dye another substance to make it look like something else. So a lot of times they'll take cheap white coral and they'll dye it red to make it seem like it's a really valuable piece. Coral is out there. I find it mixed in with costume jewelry all the time. It always sells for really good amounts. I always make quite a bit on it. So keep a lookout for that.
Sounds like we got a topic for another show, just, Matt.
Yeah, if you want to collect and get ivory, do what you want to do, but I don't personally buy it because I can't sell it, and this is all about making money for me as a business. I did end up with some of these pieces. I think your idea of donating these to a museum is actually an excellent point and something I should probably look into. I'm going to get some more information on this page turner.
Well, a museum might actually pay for it too.
Yeah, they might. I don't know. Are museums exempt from paying for illegal items? Can they do that?
I think that if it's something like that, I would bet you dimes of dollars that they are. In terms of their...
Okay.
They didn't... The reason they stopped the ivory trade is because they were killing off elephants. If a museum could determine that that was done before that, they could buy it legally and you could... You know what I mean? So there's probably a whole process.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're going to need to do another show on museum purchases. Coral. I mean,
yes.
It goes on and on, but we are out of time. I wanted to remind everybody to, if you have any questions, email us at itsjustwhatsoldpodcast@gmail.com. You can either email me or Matt. Mm-hmm. We'll both see it and we'd love to get back to you. We appreciate those of you that have been emailing us. Remember to like, follow, subscribe to the show. It's super helpful to us. And if you get a chance to write a little treatise on the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you kind of listen to it. They always have a little area where you can write up a comment. It's super helpful. Unless it's a mean comment, then please don't. But we would love, we love the involvement of the people that listen to the show. It's super cool. Any last words from you, Matt, before we head out into the day?
I think I just want to apologize for treating you like a child earlier with the Etch-a-Sketch joke. But
no,
aside from
I am
that...
your foil, my friend. That's why I'm here. I am the foil for the great Matt. I'd like to say I'm a foil for Rusty. Because if I wanted
Rusty,
to be a foil
exactly.
for anybody, it should be for Rusty. But all right,
yeah,
we have gone longer than we ever have, but we really appreciate you guys listening. We look forward to being back with you next week with a brand new show. I don't know what it's going to be. Matt keeps me on pins and needles. But thank you guys for listening. We'll talk soon.